Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're tonight's entertainment.
Look at my butt. Now look at my front butt.
Wada, 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 wada.
Open the circuit to the wave motion gun. Open the circuit.
Blood chamber pressure increases. It's at full.
All the ship's energy is now in the wave motion gun.
I doubt anyone here would recognize civic virtue if it reached up and bit you in the ass.
Oh, did I hurt your feelings?
Only Magneto's right. There's a war coming. You sure you're on the right side?
Welcome to me and Carl's very special. We don't have a live, so we're stuck here on broadcasting on a Saturday night show.
This is true. I do not have a live.
Oh, all wait. No, Carl canceled the date to be on tonight.
No,
starting
I
with whichever lady he had to cancel on.
I had a fig.
You look good.
I had a fig. I didn't have a date.
Yeah. And the reason Carl's puns, because the guy we're going to be talking about in a little bit was really one of the best punsters, monologue writers in screenwriting history.
Absolutely.
But first, I got to go to McKay's and get out of the house for a year, and here's, I'll talk a little bit what I got, because I like your Carl's opinion on it.
Okay.
The first one is a Blu-ray I found for $5, and this is the one that you're probably going to hate me for.
Okay.
It's A Boy and His Dog.
Oh, I do hate you. I absolutely despise you.
I was shocked. I was shocked. One of the only pure adaptions of Harlan Ellison's work ever, would you say?
Yeah, very much so.
Even though they tone it down like a motherfucker.
Well, not only that, there were certain things that Harlan did not like the last line of that at all. But I love it. He was relatively pleased with it.
Harlan
and
would never
movie.
Be that on the nose with his humor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he didn't like that last bit at all, that pun. He hated it. Despised it.
I don't blame him, because it's a good line, but dang. It also has Jason Robards in a great performance.
Yes.
And this one I remember Carl playing, A Boy and His Dog playing Knoxville on the Midnight Circuit.
Nice. I saw it several times in New York when I was in New York in the 80s.
Yeah.
I love that film.
And the next one is one that I really can't apologize for. There are some 70 films that are sleazy in a good way, and we love them to death. Right, Carl?
This is true.
And then there's Lipstick.
And why the fuck did you buy that? Really? Are you a pervert?
It was $3.
Are you a pervert? I wouldn't spend $3 on that piece of shit.
Hey,
and
I
own
like
Blood
Freak. There's only one thing that I asked you this earlier, and now you can answer. What's worse in Lipstick, the rape scenes or the music that Chris Sarandon's character composes?
Okay, let's make this clear. The two rape scenes, or Chris Sarandon's
well,
music.
Yeah.
Chris Sarandon's music.
Oh, my God. That music is a room clearer.
You know, they tried to make it this avant-garde stuff from the 70s, and it was so fucking poor. And you have to realize, I love 20th century classical, and that was just horrid.
It was avant-garde electronica music made by a tone-deaf asshole with no fingers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is one of those, if we had time, I would not fucking bring that music in here. No. Carl would kill me before he let me play it.
Absolutely.
I'm being literal.
The only way I will ever let you play that is if I go completely deaf.
And even then, Beethoven called the person that composed the music an asshole from his grave.
Yes.
And the next is the best race relation film of the whole race relation subgenre of the late 60s. I hope you agree with me. And that's In the Heat of the Night.
Oh, great film. Great film.
Yeah. And this is a film that Sidney Poitier should have won an Oscar for, not Lilies of the Field, and I do love me some Lilies of the Field.
Well, I think he should have won it for both, okay? I thought he was great in Lilies. And the Defiant ones, too. Don't forget that.
Oh, yeah. But what I love about In the Heat of the Night is that at the beginning of the movie, Rod Steiger and his character hate each other.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the movie, they still don't fucking like each other.
But they respect each other.
They respect each other, but they don't like each other.
Nope. And, of course, Steiger is a Southern lawman, and there's a murder, and it brings this Northern black detective played by Sidney Poitier down to the South while there's still segregation and all that. So, yeah.
How the hell does a nigger make $10 an hour up north? I'm a cop. One of the best lines ever.
Mm-hmm.
And next is something I know Carl covets, and that's the 3-disc Imperial edition of Caligula. If it was 4-disc, it'd be a lot worth more.
But the
and
three
that's
disc
because
is...
originally, the 3-disc is all that exists. Originally, it was supposed to come with the soundtrack. But literally, 3 hours before shipping, which delayed it 2 or 3 weeks, the people who recorded the soundtrack saying, no, we won't let you use it. We're embarrassed of this music. You can't use this music. So they had to take all of the sets that were complete, unwrap them, take out the soundtrack disc, wrap them up again.
Jesus.
But if you like Caligula or Malcolm McDowell's performance in it, this is the fucking place to get.
Tell them about
Tino Brass's original cut, the porno cut,
and the R-rated.
Two commentaries with Malcolm McDowell and Helen Mirren, where she says the one line in the commentary just puts her, I worship her now as much as Carl does.
I love her.
You know the scene in the Imperial Boat where the three harpies as Malcolm McDowell are going down on that guy, just giving him head?
Yes.
Helen Mirren goes, I can do that better than them. And you know that one scene you've always thought that maybe Helen Mirren was actually going down on that girl?
Yes.
She was. And she gives no fucks.
She doesn't care. That's one of the reasons I love her. I first noticed her in Oh Lucky Man, but ever since then, man, she's just great. And she has this I don't give a fuck attitude that's just wonderful.
And thankfully, Malcolm McDowell and Helen Mirren don't hate the movie. So they have some good, it's not a, oh God, this piece of shit thing. Malcolm talks shit on about those three girls that are in the extra porn scenes. It's one of the most surreal fucking stories I've ever heard in my life. One of the girls walked up to Malcolm right before they were going to film the scene of him on the ship.
Right.
And looks at him with an insane grin and goes, I want to suck your cock. And Malcolm goes, take this crazy bitch off the set. Get her off now. And 20 minutes later, she snuck back on the set and says it to him again. And then he starts raising holy hell. And me and Carl have an ongoing debate, which really isn't no way neither of us are going to win.
Right.
And that is, what is the best one-time directed film and one-time director only? Because I say, when I say it, Night of the Hunter, Carl goes, yes, but. And I look at him and go, you're right. And then when he goes, it's Carnival of Souls, and I go, yes, but. And he goes, you're right. So it's pretty much a tie for number one, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I would. And close behind is Phase 4, but not up with those two.
Oh, Lord, no. This is, someone probably stole it because didn't Criterion put Carnival of Souls out on Blu-ray last year?
Something like that, yeah. I don't have it on Blu-ray. I've got the original Criterion on DVD, though, and I'm happy with that.
Oh, I'm happy with it, too. I mean, two cuts of the movie. History on Centron Films.
Yep.
If you like your ghost stories, you need to watch Carnival of Souls because this is the one where a lot of them stole from.
Absolutely.
Anytime you ran into a, oh my God, this, even The Sixth Sense owes its twist ending to Carnival of Souls. How many minutes could we really start saying movies that owe their twist to Carnival of Souls?
Like every damn gross story after that.
Even the others, even though it was a twist on the twist.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one, I got a crap load more, but I really just want to talk about these, is Ernest Dickerson directed this. Surviving the Game. As soon as I seen him, I'm like, yeah, that's why I like it so damn much. Jesus, was this guy on in the 90s or what?
Oh, absolutely.
Bones,
unfortunately, a lot of his stuff, it didn't hit. You know, I mean, but it's really good. He really did some good films.
Bones. Demon Knight, Juice, Surviving the Game. Didn't he do a Masters of Horror, too?
Yeah. No, he did not do a Masters of Horror. They asked him, but he couldn't schedule it.
I mean,
he's
this guy knows how to make a
now.
Good B-movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Just look at the cast in Surviving the Game. Besides Ice-T, there's Rutger Hauer, Gary Busey, F. Murray Abraham. If that isn't the bad guys you want to go after, you know, you've seen it, haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
It's getting harder to find great no-budget popcorn movies like it.
Well, the thing is, these days, you know, you have all the streaming services. You've got to go through, you know, a rash or a crap to find a good, solid B-action film.
Yeah, well, at least we got what's-his-name that's in Undisputed. Anytime I see him in the movie, I'm like, oh, we got to stop and watch this shit.
No, Undisputed. Walter Hill, buddy. You can't do much better than Walter Hill.
I'm talking two or three.
Oh, okay.
The one with Scott Adkins in it.
Oh, yeah. Michael
and
J. White, right?
Jean-Claude Van Damme was really up to his game. I'm like, damn, where the hell were you? Where the hell were you in the 90s? We could have used you as an actor, you asshole.
Yep.
But we're here because one of our fate, we can't be sad talking about these guys because we just look at the sheer amount of lines that we have to quote from him. And and me and him, we do this, we've done this all the time since we've been friends, haven't we?
Yes.
Quote Vladdy lines to each other. Like last night on the show when I let off, I talked about the all great and almighty Foot.
Yep.
And this will be William Peter Blatty, who said the two worst things that ever happened to him in his life, and he said this jokingly, was he had hit. He was a comedy guy who had a big hit with his first film. And when he tried to do a serious drama, they said to him, no, you can't do that. You're the comedy guy. And when he wrote what most people consider the best horror film of the 70s, and what does our 70s guy think of that claim?
I'd say you can't argue that. You really can't.
Yeah.
You know, it's so influential, and it was such a shocking film for its time. And, of course, don't forget that Blatty, you know, wrote the novel beforehand. Okay, because he had gotten out of screenwriting.
And don't forget, it put more asses in church than any biblical movie before or after it.
Yeah, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. But you're absolutely right. You'll tell the story. It's a great story.
Yeah. But once he hit with horror, he couldn't go write comedy again. They said, no, you're the horror guy. Why was the typecasting really that bad in the 70s? And how
was
your guy
in the 70s? Remember, he wrote his first film was The Man from the Diner's Club, which was a moderate hit for
Danny Kaye. Yeah, we'll get to that. Well, what I asked you is this. How the fuck did your guys have their hits and avoid the typecasting curse?
Well, did they really? Okay, Altman. What do you
Altman
say about Altman? Altman was an Altman film. Okay, but the thing is, what happened with Blatty was that it really started in the 60s because he worked in the 60s, and then he was the comedy guy. He got out of film. He did The Exorcist as a novel. Then they had him adapt it, and then he was the horror guy. So it's this attitude that's more from the 60s than the 70s. You know, I mean, the one thing is he did ride that individualistic sense in the 70s because he did, you know, a film that's almost uncategorizable, and that's The Ninth Configuration based on Twinkle.
Get into that.
Twinkle, Twinkle, Killer Kane. And then Exorcist 3, which isn't exactly, you know, what you expect, to say the least.
Yeah. And for a guy who called himself an agnostic, am I right?
Yeah, he didn't call himself an atheist. He definitely was an agnostic. And
he was a very,
that...
very spiritual person. As a matter of fact, before he started writing scripts, he was a Jesuit student.
Yep.
And Carl, as someone who loves his religion like you do, how hard is it to find intelligent conversation about it in film?
It's not easy. There are some exceptions, but it's not the norm.
Yeah, like the one that you love the best, Calvary.
Yeah, now that one, no question. That one is beautiful, and that's written by an atheist, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. There was a. Do you remember
Isn't it
Wonderfalls?
Funny that. What?
Do you remember Wonderfalls? There was this one line from Wonderfalls because the character was studying theology. And he says, do you realize how many atheists are getting their master's in theology? You know,
isn't it funny that most atheists who make religious movies are more reverent than the people who are hardcore religious and make religious
absolutely.
Movies?
You know, another one, too, is J. Michael Straczynski, who did Babylon 5. And the religious aspect of that is amazing. And between him
and
Harlan
course,
Ellison,
the
two are valid
the famous
atheists.
Line from Firefly. Yeah.
Okay.
One of my favorite Harlan Ellison short stories, and it's very Blatty-esque humor, is the one about the guy looking for the Holy Grail.
Yes.
And then he finds it, and then 2 seconds later it disappears, and he goes, what now? And God basically shows up and goes, well, you found the Holy Grail. Just go on and live your life.
Yep. No, but
Blatty's first film was what? Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Stephen. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
All right. Well, Blatty is an interesting character in terms of his relation with his characters. As the movies go on and his writing gets a little more tenured, it becomes, it's all about the characters and the interrelations. And that's where the dialogue comes in, and that's where the monologues come in. And there's nobody out there that could make a horror movie more human than Blatty. You know, it was. That's the one thing I really think about both the original Exorcist and then Legion Exorcist 3. They were human. They were human characters that you could really connect with.
Now, but he started out, like I said, as a Jesuit priest, and then he left to become a writer. His first job was on a Danny Kaye movie, The Man from the Diner's Club, which is another, wasn't it one of the first of the it's in that whole technological scare gene genre.
No, not really, no. It's basically, Danny Kaye gives Telly Savalas the Diner's Club card, and Danny and Savalas is a gangster, and the people that work with him want Danny Kaye to rescind it and take it away from Savalas. That's what the whole setup is.
Yeah,
it's not
what
really...
I mean, it's like films like Twonky, The Net.
No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all. You're thinking of a different movie. This is very much just a simple setup for Danny Kaye shenanigans. There's nothing technological about it.
And
now, John
Goldfarb
has been into that a little bit, but not Diner's Club.
And plus, both are human. I mean, I can remember watching it, and Telly Savalas gets hurt when they when he finds out that they want the card back.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's very funny. It's a little dated, but it's a cute comedy. And
the Diner Club was the first real credit card ever issued.
Mhm. Yep, and long gone now. They finally phased out in the '80s, late '80s, I think.
Diners Club, I think, were absorbed by MasterCard.
Maybe. I'm not sure. That makes sense, though.
But, yeah, and it was a pretty big hit because pretty much anything Danny Kaye done was okay. I mean, there is some Danny Kaye stuff that I love, like, what was it, the one where he was in the olden days?
The Court Jester.
The Jester or something. What?
The Court Jester.
Yeah, with
the pestle and the thistle.
Yeah, that one. With the most tongue-tying fucking monologue in the history of monologues.
Yes.
How the fuck did both of those guys pull that off? I will never freaking know.
I know. It's pretty amazing. It really is.
And I also loved Secret Life of Walter Mitty. That one was good.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
That one got the story better than the one with
Ben Stiller.
No,
I have to admit, the Ben Stiller one, I was actually surprised that I liked. I did like it.
Oh, I'm not saying it's bad. It's another. That one goes with Dawn of the Dead and the 98 Godzilla with films like, why the fuck did they give it a name like that? Why the fuck did they burden it with the other story's name when they could have just called it something else and it probably would have been received better?
Mm-hmm.
I'll never understand why they want to give a movie unneeded baggage. Because, one, the people who don't know it won't give a shit, and the people who don't know it will be pissed off.
Mm-hmm. True. But anyway, let's keep going with Blatty.
Yeah. And what was the one, you know it more than I do, Goldfarb or whatever?
John Goldfarb, Please Come Home.
Is that
I watched about
going
a half
for,
hour of that today. When I was a kid,
is that
going
on your Jewish show, too?
No. No, this is not Jewish. This is Arabic, actually.
Well, Goldfarb sounds Jewish, the name.
Basically, it's a sultan's son is a star at the Notre Dame football team. He comes back to Arabia, an unnamed place, and they have built a football field in the middle of the desert. And it's all about, you know, the ambassadors and all this stuff, and someone's trying to kidnap the boy, and it's silly. It's just silly. But Peter Ustinov
the usual mishmash.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And
does it have anybody that's worth their salt in it?
Oh, yeah. Shirley MacLaine. There's, of course, Peter Ustinov. There's all sorts of British guys. Wilford Hyde-White, Terry Thomas, Richard Deacon is in it, who was best known from Dick Van Dyke Show. There are all sorts of character actors, man.
Ooh, I love Terry Thomas. Wilford Hyde-White will always be the minty little guy with the poodles in Theater of Blood.
Yes. Oh, no, that's Robert Morley. No, Wilford Hyde-White was a thin guy with glasses. But you would know him, too, trust me.
Yeah, I know him. I know the name. See, even God makes mistakes.
Yes, this is true. Wilford Hyde-White had a part as John Gielgud's second-in-command I love it. The what about the funerals, the pet funerals, and Robert Morris and that.
The loved one.
The loved one. Thank you. I was having the brain fart.
Yeah. And wasn't his next film was really the film that made him the second.
Absolutely.
First sequel to the Pink
to
Panther.
To Pink Panther. A Shot in the Dark. By far the
and
best
I love
of
it
the Clouseau films. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I love the one where Herbert Lom goes fucking nuts and becomes the bad guy. But A Shot in the Dark is just so much better and funnier.
Oh, yeah. It's by far... If you take a look at Blatty's career and put the line down between comedy and horror, this is his top comedy. Easily.
Are you naked, sir? No, sir. I have on a guitar. Can't you see?
And, of course, Peter Sellers is just, a gem. And everybody in the film is just perfect. And it is very unusual. It doesn't happen often where the sequel is better than the original. But in this case, absolutely.
Well, they realized that Clouseau was the money character, not the thief. They remember, their original intention was that the thief character was supposed to be the continuing character, not Clouseau.
Right. But Sellers did such a bang-up job as that character, they knew that that was the character, not the David Niven character.
Yeah. Time when he wrote Shot in the Dark, he was haunted about this case that he heard about in seminary school and started doing research on it. And what was the movie that he did after Shot in the Dark?
Darling Lily.
Yeah.
Which is a spy.
That was one that he did so he could have the money where he could write his book on that case that he learned about in Jesuit school.
Right, exactly. And the case is a boy, it's based in 1947, a boy was possessed in Maryland. And so he really researched this. He really researched the Catholic Church and that sort of thing and what all the rites were with exorcism. And he, after he did Darling Lily, he basically took a 2-year hiatus and wrote The Exorcist.
Came and that should show you how much he was getting paid for a comedy, to write a comedy script, that he could take the money off of one film and basically retire for 2 years to write the book.
Right. And I'm sure he did other things too, but yeah, that's exactly what he did. And I think it came out in early 71. The book.
Yeah. And when it came out, his publisher called him the next week, and Blatty was scared to death. He's like, oh, God. He's like, we got the first week sales in. Oh, God. You beat The Godfather. What? Yes, you beat The Godfather. You're the number one book in the USA.
Dead silence.
Yeah. And that book would be The Exorcist. That book, well, I didn't get to the movie first. That book was just a game changer back then. Even you were just in your first, just getting into the doubles, weren't you?
Well, I was, when I came out, I was 13 years old. I had read,
that's what I'm saying.
By that time, I had read Robert Bloch and all these horror writers. So immediately when that came out, I read it. I thought it was a good
read. Yeah, but
what
I'm saying is that you knew about the hype before that.
No, not particularly. Not particularly.
Well,
I remember that
number
hit.
One book in America, number one book in America, the book that horrified the world.
Oh yeah, but this is right when it came out, okay? Before it had, you know, I got it probably within a week or two after it was released. Okay? And I read it right away. I loved that stuff, you know. I mean, it was right up my alley. I was reading sci-fi and reading horror, and that book was basically a gut punch, you know. Excuse me. By that time, Stephen King hadn't been writing yet, and so the people I knew in the horror realm was particularly Robert Bloch and Matheson, Richard Matheson. And this one was much more in your face than either one of those. It did a number on me. It did a number on me. I was shaking when I read it.
The book really was, the book was a very major cultural event, and it is. And yes, we had, the closest thing I could describe it to was the tiny bubble fart in the bathtub that Fifty Shades of Grey did when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, a book could be a major cultural fucking event.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't really alive at that time. Tell us, Carl, what was it like that a book could be a major cultural event in the country and the world?
Well, it's not like it doesn't happen now, okay? But back then, it was, what was different about it was this was a horror book, okay? This was something that was, you know, genre-related, very niche, and no one expected it to have this impact. And the interesting thing about the impact was the blowback from the church, because since this is a very, very religious Catholic book, you know, that's, you know, the Catholic Church had some real, you know, soul searching on this one, you know, what is it? So a lot of people, you know, had a real reaction to that. Now it multiplied when the film came out. When the film came out, you got to tell that story.
Wait. And here's another question for you: what action movie blew everybody away with its amazing car chase that also came out in 1971, the same year as the book?
Well, that would be The French Connection. You know, and that would be, of course, what's his name? Friedkin, William Friedkin. And Friedkin read the book and just said, this is my next movie. It's got to be this. And
ironically, you could fade off stage left to a movie theater where William Brady was relaxing from his book tour and watching The French Connection, and he turned to his friend, he said, this is the guy I want to do The Exorcist if they ever make it into a movie.
Yep. Yeah, and the interesting thing is when his death notice came yesterday, it was through Friedkin, because they have been in some very close, in fact, he says in the long version that, like my adopted brother. They were extremely close.
And he said he knew they were brothers because he wanted to kill the son of a bitch but loved him 2 seconds later.
Exactly. Yeah, they would get into some hot and heavy stuff during the filming.
Yeah. But what happened is Warner Brothers bought the rights, and Blatty had enough stroke, because the book was selling that damn big, to really say who they wanted he wanted to direct the film. So he was walking over to Friedkin's office, and Friedkin didn't know that, and he was walking over to meet Blatty, and it was like, here's how they met. I want the director.
Okay.
Oh. Okay. And Friedkin has said that that book was a godsend in his career.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, you talk about a film. Okay, so the book had this really big impact, but the film just magnified it by 100-fold. Good Lord.
Oh, on Exorcist 3, the guy that played Dyer in it?
Yeah, Flanders.
He said that the day that The Exorcist came out, he was at a deli across the street from a movie theater in New York City, and he looked outside, and it was raining and stuff, and he seen the line for The Exorcist stretched around the block.
Yep. You know, even in the 80s, that wasn't that unusual. but, yeah.
In the 70s and 80s, it wasn't that unusual. But once the studios took over and they saturated the films of death, it was a pretty rare occurrence.
Right. But this is the 70s, of course, so it wasn't as rare.
The film really exploded.
And, of course, you talk
but
about
we got to talk
actors.
About the cast now.
Yeah, exactly. That's where we're going.
For some reason, William Peter Blatty had just seen The Seventh Seal. And he fell in love with Max von Sydow. And he got him to be in the movie. He told you, I want you to play Father Mary. He's like, I'm too young to play the role. I can't do it. And he's like, don't worry, we'll work it out. And what movie, wasn't Little Big Man out before The Exorcist?
Say it again?
Little Big Man.
Yes.
Wasn't it out before The Exorcist?
Yes.
Yeah. After Blatty and Friedkin seen Dick Miller's work in that, they're like, this is the man we want to do The Exorcist. And
yeah, we're talking about
the
makeup man, not the actor.
Yeah, Dick Miller, the makeup guy, the god. But yeah, and then he, and what's scary is, have you seen the comparison pictures of how Max Sydow looked at 80 and how they had the Father Mary makeup?
Yep.
Pretty goddamn close.
Yeah, no shit.
He was like, goddamn, shit, he did good. And also, Blatty had just gone and seen this play called This Winning Season.
That championship
and
season.
The playwright had to take a role in the play because the actor that played that role was sick. And Blatty fell in love with him, and he said, that's our Father Karras.
Mm-hmm.
And who was
that? Be Jason Miller. Jason Miller.
Miller. And the studio forced Lee J. Cobb in the role of Kinderman.
Which is not bad.
No. They wanted a proven Hollywood star in the role.
But Lee J. Cobb actually does a good job.
Yeah. And do you remember who was up for the role of Chris McNeil before Friedkin got his choice?
No. You're talking about Ellen Burstyn got the role. You're talking about that.
Yeah, Ellen Burstyn got the part, but the studio wanted Shirley MacLaine.
I can't see that. I mean, I can, but
no.
It wouldn't be as good.
No. We love you, Shirley, but unless the role's a sassy, smart-ass type, you really don't fit it that well.
Yeah, and of course, don't forget that Blatty had worked with Shirley MacLaine, too.
Yeah.
On John Goldfarb. No, that wouldn't have worked. So they got Ellen Burstyn, who was a Broadway actress at that time, had done a couple of small roles.
I mean, really, if you look at the casting of The Exorcist, it was like, what the hell were they doing? They didn't hire no name stars. They hired some guy that people knew from foreign films but never had a U.S. hit.
Yeah. Well, you know,
and
one of the
Jody
things
Foster
that Blatty
was
trying to do was trying to get away from the sense of a star, because if you get a real star in any of those roles, you immediately think not as a character, but, oh, that's the star playing the character.
Yeah.
You know, and they were trying to get away from that.
I think the biggest star in the movie in America would probably be either Lee J. Cobb or the guy that played Dennings.
Probably Lee J. Cobb, I would think.
Yeah. But, yeah, the movie had some odd occurrences during filming. There were people hurt, and there was all sorts of screw-ups on the set. And they hired Linda Blair for the role. This was her first role. They wanted someone with that sweet, innocent, cherubic face. So when she started saying, they're like, why do you want such a sweet, innocent girl? Because if it was a tough girl, if she yelled out, motherfucker, it wouldn't be shocking. But you look at this sweet, innocent, cherubic little girl, and she goes, burn in hell, motherfucker. You're like, what?
Well, let's, okay, so we need to talk about one other person in the cast, which you have not mentioned. Okay, and she doesn't appear in the movie at all. But her voice does.
Oh, Mercedes
and that would
McCambridge.
Be Mercedes McCambridge, who dubbed all the voicing.
The fucking torture they put her through.
Oh, God. The torture, for, you know, both Mercedes McCambridge and Linda Blair had a rough fucking shoot, man, on this.
Yeah, they made Mercedes, before each voice thing, swallow a glass full of raw eggs and smoke a half a pack of Camels.
Yeah, I mean, they did, and a lot of it was not audibly changed. There was some computer work on there, not much though. But
yeah,
man,
if you get the DVD of the original, there is the raw voice work from Mercedes McCambridge on there.
And it is amazing. It's friggin' amazing.
And
you know,
we're forgetting the third actress, too.
Okay.
Eileen Deetz.
Okay, what role did she play?
She was a stand-in for Linda Blair. She's the one who did all the pea soup vomiting scenes. She did the spider walk.
Yep.
But
they
filmed the movie, and they were shocked how big it was. And yes, the Catholic Church did condemn the movie when it came out.
Can I take it from here? Because
until,
I love this story.
Until one little fact happened.
Well, you see,
that
the Catholic League of Decency, which was still going on at that time, when it came out, they gave it a condemned rating. And then the Pope came in and saw the movie. And basically, The Exorcist is the only movie ever to get a dispensation from the Pope. And the Pope said...
And don't forget the other thing.
What?
The guy that played Father Dyer, he was a member of the New York diocese.
Right.
He said that confessions went up 80%.
Oh, yeah.
After the movie came out.
I mean, but
the and
thing
the church
was
said,
finish
and I
up.
Quote, "This movie put more asses in the seats in
church
than any religious movie before that."
Well, I want to finish up what
and
I was saying. Okay, I want to finish up what I was saying. Just give me a minute. Okay, so what happened? Okay, so the Pope went to see the movie and then made a statement in the National Dispensation saying that we're going to give it an A rating because it accurately depicts, you know, the faith and the stamina that a priest must go through for an exorcism, and accurately depicts the rituals and puts the church in a good light. So to me, what really blows me away is that it got a dispensation from the Pope. Yes, it got a lot of seats in church. No doubt about that, but it's the only movie in history that got a dispensation from the Pope. There you go.
And honestly, there have been people throughout the years that are going, "Oh, I don't understand what's so scary about the exorcist. I don't understand why people get so freaked out." And I look at them, I just say, "Are you Catholic?" "No." "Okay, you won't understand."
Mm-hmm. No, it is the Catholic horror movie, without a doubt. It's the Catholic horror movie.
How did you first see it?
Oh, I saw it in the theater. I was 15 years old. And in fact, I take that back, I saw that at the drive-in. That was brought,
nice.
He brought that in. Yeah, I saw it in the drive-in.
Why wouldn't he bring it in? That was sure thing in the 70s.
Oh, absolutely. But remember, you know, Howard did like a lot of weird stuff too. You know, like he was independent.
Yeah.
But whenever a big hit like that came in, it came in.
And it was a big hit, and it made Blatty a star. But the problem is it made him a horror star, and he really couldn't get anything done. And both him and Friedkin turned her back on The Exorcist too. Because their idea for The Exorcist 2, which came out later in a different form, did not involve Linda Blair or any direct, really, follow-up to
the original movie
plot. But there was this one scene in The Exorcist that really intrigued Blatty. There was this astronaut named Cutshaw who was there having a party about 3 weeks before he went up on the air. And then he had Linda Blair's character walk in and tell him, "You're going to die up there." And then she pisses on the floor. And he decided to do a movie about the Cutshaw care, and that book became Twinkle Twinkle Killer Kane, which is a good title, but it makes it seem like a goddamn slasher movie, doesn't it?
I always thought either it was a slasher movie. When I first thought it, I thought it was going to be a detective movie, a detective story. That's sort of what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
What it became was something that's pretty weird. A very, very black comedy.
Yeah. And then he went and after cajoling, he changed it to what I consider a better title, don't you?
I kind of like Twinkle Twinkle Killer Kane, but I think that the ninth configuration is more in terms of what it's really about. So I guess I would say it's a better
title. Yeah, and the setup for the ninth configuration does did you know that that actually was real, Carl? They actually did open asylums like that, and this
man, I knew about that maybe a little later.
Yeah, he donated it to the army. What happened was is they had people who were going crazy because they had to send to Vietnam, and the military thought they were faking it. So they sent them to these designated asylums so they can really suss out, are they crazy or not? And Blatty liked that so much story so much that he mixed it with the Cutshaw story, and that's where the knife configuration come in. To really say how bizarre this movie really is how many cuts of it have you seen, Carl, different cuts?
I've only seen one cut. One complete cut, and I've seen bits from another cut.
I've seen five cuts.
I know. There's a lot of them.
The VHS cut, the middle cut, which cuts out the scene with Robert Loggia in blackface singing the Moses Gunn dressed as Superman. Yes, it's that kind of movie. And then there was a third cut where it was the ending was changed, and they cut out the scene of them singing Happy Birthday. And then there was the fourth cut, which puts back Happy Birthday and the scene with Robert Loggia. And then there's the fifth cut, which is the one that's on DVD.
Wow.
This is a movie they did not know what the fuck to do with. Because it's easy to tell you what this film isn't. It ain't an action film. Well, yes it is. It ain't a porno film. Okay, there, I finally got one. Is that about the only thing that it isn't?
Let's see. Is it a horror movie? Not really.
But, yeah.
Is it a psychological thriller? A little bit, maybe.
Yeah.
Is it a comedy? Fuck yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's I consider it a black comedy. That's the way I look at it.
It's a very black comedy. And it has some of the best fucking actors in a movie ever. Moses Gunn, the guy from Eaten Alive, who was it that starred in that?
Neville Brand.
Neville Brand, Jason Miller, Joe Spinell, Stacy Keach, Ed Flanders, in our second favorite performance by him in a Blatty film.
Exactly.
Richard fucking Lynch.
Yeah.
And it was reported that shoot was pure insanity. And if you look at anything that comes on the film, yes it is.
Well, you know, the other thing that we have to talk about, because Blatty directed this, okay? So do you know how he got to be the director?
He had that much stroke after The Exorcist 3 that he told them, I'm going to do a movie about the astronaut from The Exorcist. Ooh, Exorcist sequel? And then they saw what they had wrought. And Warner Brothers sold it off to New World Pictures.
And they never got a real proper release to it.
No. It's a very, very surreal movie. I mean, this movie has weirdness on top of weirdness on top of weirdness. like Scott Wilson going around calling God the Almighty Foot. And him wearing a St. Christopher's medal with a, if found, call a Buddhist. Yeah, call a Buddhist monk.
It's just really strange. That's really strange.
And it's
and that's the
and
other
it's
thing, too.
Fucking it's fucking brilliant.
Oh, I'm not saying it isn't. It is a acquired taste. I would say that.
Oh, God, yes.
It's an acquired taste. It's like tonic water. You don't like tonic water at the first time. But I love it after years. So, you know, I mean, that's the kind of movie.
It's one of those I've learned not to recommend to people.
Unless you know them very well and they're weird.
Yeah. And Stacy Keach is just pure brilliance in this movie.
He is. It's a really interesting film, and the one thing I have to say about it is, again, his penchant for writing, and there's a couple of dialogues in there, and monologues, and scenes that are just so well written. The scene where the guy goes into Stacy Keach's office when he first gets there, it's just like, wow.
Yeah.
I mean,
He was in the lunch hall and he squirted a thin line of ketchup on his neck and he fell backwards on a table and looked at his administrator and said, "Don't eat the swordfish." Or where he talks about him and his medal. He's like, "What do you think of this medal?" "Oh, it's very nice. I knew you were coveting my medal, you son of a bitch." Or the one where it has Joe Spinell trying to put on Hamlet with dogs. And it has Jason Miller cursing out a Pekingese. "Stuck up little bitch. I told you we should have let her gone to the William Morris Agency." It has this one
Superman
bashing. What?
Well, what I was going to say is, here's Blatty going back to his comedic roots in a really strange way. You know, and if you go back to John Goldfarb, that's really out there too. So, you know, he has this sense of doing comedy that is just like, where does that come from? It comes from a different universe. And that's what
plus
the night configuration is.
Will break your heart. There's no ifs, ands, or buts.
Oh, at the end, yeah.
I can remember there's a monologue by Ed Sanders towards the end of the movie. If you're not crying by the end of it, you're not human.
No.
And the very end scene that involves two of the players, if you notice, it's a direct lift off Dionysus carrying his son.
It's
a
really good film.
You know what
I'm
talking about, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
Don't you, Carl?
I do. But it's a film that needs to be rediscovered. And so if you are of an adventurous nature, and I would say many of you are, if you listen to us, you should be adventurous, definitely give this one a shot. It's well worth it. And it's the unsung gem,
yeah,
as far as I'm concerned.
I seen it on VHS. It was it was during when Mike Hammer was at its biggest. So all I seen was a mystery thriller unlike anything you've ever seen. I'm like, Stacy Keach. I'm like, soul. And then I had two thoughts while watching it. One, what the fuck is this? And I love it. How did you first see it?
I ended up seeing it on HBO. So the only cut I've ever seen is the HBO cut, which I'm pretty sure was the theatrical or the New World cut.
Yeah.
And it's been a while, but damn, I just remember seeing it and saying, this is unusual. And I saw it like two times or three times during the time they were running it. You know, they would always run films like four or five times a month. So I made a point of seeing it. I saw it like two or three times in a row. And I was just like amazed. Like, this is something
and
new.
And before we move on to the last film, the weirdest goddamn thing is that Rolling Thunder and The Ninth Configuration have the same opening song.
Yeah, they do.
And I like how he takes this in the next film we're going to talk about and pretty much uses The Exorcist as a butterfly effect. The Exorcist is a butterfly, and the next two films is about the reverberations of that butterfly flapping its wings.
The first one, of course, is the one we just talked about, which was The Ninth Configuration.
The Ninth Configuration was the cut, y'all. And around then, 90, after years of him and Freakin' not being able to get their version of what they wanted to do for Exorcist 2 off the ground, he decides to write a book about it. And it came out, and it was called Legion, The
Legion.
Further Adventures of William Kinderman. And it's an amazing book. But if you love the movie, don't go into the book expecting the movie. It's a wholly different beast.
Yeah, the book is amazing. I thought The Exorcist was good. The Legion is two times the book that Exorcist is. It's just amazing film. Amazing book. And again, it's what I said at the beginning. Blatty talks about the characters, and makes them human in a very unhuman world. And the dialogue and everything and the relationships in that film just jump off the page like they're right next to you, and you're watching it. It's such a wonderful book. And it is disturbing beyond belief. I think it's better than the original Exorcist. What do you think, Stephen?
I love the book. But like I said, if you watch the movie and you love the movie, don't go in expecting the movie. But if you haven't read the book because you thought that you had seen it would just be the movie, then get the book.
Yeah.
And the book was a major freaking hit, critically, of course, and sales-wise. So they hire him. And this is one of Morgan Creek's biggest mistakes, and I'm fucking glad they made it.
What?
They hired Blatty to direct it.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks they hadn't seen The Ninth Configuration. What about you?
They probably didn't. Or else they would have gotten someone else.
Yeah. But all these years, they're like, William Peter Blatty directs The Exorcist 3, Exorcist 3. And then there were like 98% of them, I'm sure Carl's with me, they were like, ooh, William Peter Blatty's directing me. It's going to be a good sequel to The Exorcist after the piece of shit that Exorcist 2 was. And then there was the 2%, which was me and Carl's like, holy shit, they're letting a guy to direct The Ninth Configuration direct another movie? Oh boy, this is going to be fun.
But the thing is, I think it was a good move. Because, again, the movie, though it's different than the book, and yes, there were constraints by the studio that he had to change things and so on and so forth, But what comes through is the relationships and the dialogue and the writing. This has to be, Exorcist 3 has to be one of the most literate scripts for a horror movie I have ever seen. Ever.
Yeah.
And it is just, the cast is just fucking phenomenal. I mean,
the
it's
one
just
thing
unbelievable.
He used from his stock company was Ed Flanders, Scott
mm-hmm.
Wilson, Jason Miller after the reshoots.
And
the
Nancy Fish.
Oh, and you'll be holy shit. Guess who plays the, and you probably didn't recognize him. Well, you probably did, but the guy who plays Kinderman's second-in-command, the guy with the gray hair that Kinderman's always insulting as being an idiot and a racist.
Yeah, he was on a TV show. I can't remember his name, but he was on a TV show. He was on Kojak, I think.
Yeah, and he was the cop in the Mac.
Right. Oh, that's right.
And he was the cop in Dolomite. Pretty much, if you watch Blaxploitation, there was an asshole cop in that movie. It was him.
You know, and we're talking about his rep company, the nurse, the head nurse, who was played by Nancy Fish, had small roles in both Night Configuration. She was one of the nurses, I think, in that. And then she had a walk-on role on the original Exorcist. So she was another one of the.
And I want to say this to all you Walking Dead fans out there. Fuck you. Scott Wilson is not the guy from Walking Dead. He's the guy from In Cold Blood, Knife Configuration, and Exorcist 3.
He's had a great career, but nobody knows it. Seriously.
I'm nobody then. My name is Nobody.
Absolutely. And I'm Tony O'Valeri. Okay, never mind. Really, really obscure reference. Anyway.
And it has one of the greatest insults of all time, which really has been adopted by almost everybody. Right, Carl?
That's certainly your favorite insult. Go right ahead, because I've heard this a hundred times.
Yeah. And it said, and basically he said, what did you say to our most famous donor? He's very upset. He said, God loves you. Everyone else thinks you're an asshole. That movie is just so quotable.
Well, so let's talk about the cast a little bit. Okay? So for Kinderman, Lee J. Cobb was dead by that point. And they had to hire someone. And I think they absolutely got a plum of an actor for Kinderman. And that would be
George C. Scott. He is just great in almost every freaking, every time, he's just great in every scene. His line when he looked at that cop when he's walking out, he said, I'll see you all tomorrow. Go home, Waterman, and talk about Watts. And now I'll bring up Carl's favorite scene.
But again, they're given a script that's just so literate and so character-driven. And George C. Scott generally goes over the top. Let's face it, he is. But in this one, he's very reserved until it's time to go over the top. And boy, does it work.
In the director's cut, it never does go over the top.
Okay, well, of course, they just came out with director's cut, and I don't have it yet.
Yeah.
But I love it that it goes over the top in the theatrical cut at the end.
Yeah. I know how much you love his speech when he's on the wall.
Oh, fuck, I love that speech. The speech is brilliant.
I believe in anal sex. You sound like a demented preacher when he says that line.
I believe in you. You son of a bitch.
Yeah, I'm a bitch. And
now, another
some of the new
cast in
there is wonderful, too.
There's two other actors we have to mention. So the story is that there is this person in that is locked up who claims he's a Gemini killer. And they needed to find an actor for that. Do you want to go through what happened here and tell the story?
It was almost going to be a sure thing. He already knew who he wanted, so he went to Jason Miller, and he found out that he was really so far gone in his alcoholism that he couldn't read the lines. So there was this guy who had already been nominated for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and had a pretty decent career of his own, and really was on a career high performing the voice of Chucky in Child's Play. And that will be the great Brad Dourif. And he said that he took the role in a heartbeat because he said, "You mean I get to recite all of these wonderful monologues? I'm there."
And so what happened too? Tell them what happened with the reshoots.
Well, what happened is he filmed his director's cut, which, you know, 90% of the time we're like, fuck the man, they totally screwed his movie, they screwed his movie. No, not this time. The ending was really too quiet and out of nowhere. So they filmed a bunch of reshoots. And by that time, Jason Miller had sobered up enough. Well, they did use him, and both of them together put on a great performance. Jason Miller is great. Sadly, he was dead a year later from problems due to his alcoholism.
Right. So spoilers, of course. So you have Brad Dourif as the Gemini killer, but Jason Miller is also the Gemini killer. So you have Father Karras. You see what happens there. And I think that actually makes it work better. Because you have the connection. You know, another person, of course, the company that was releasing it said, well, this is an Exorcist 3. That's what we're going to release it as. So where's the exorcism? And so they forced Vladdy.
Before we go into this, we want to say something for the record, and I hope Carl agrees with me. Nicole Williamson was the best damn Merlin ever in film history. Ever.
Ever. Period.
But
agreed.
He was not any good, and the script writing of his part was not any good in Exorcist 3. Because he has no contact with anybody else in the cast except for Jason Miller.
And George C. Scott, sort of, kind of.
Well, no, that was a double laying on the floor. It wasn't Nicole.
Right, okay.
Do you think they could have gotten Nicole Williamson to lay on the freaking floor for like hours at a time?
Probably not.
But it's so literal. I mean, how many other movies do you think are going to reference Billy Burke? It's a Wonderful Life. The Red Shoes.
I mean, you know, I want to go to one more cast member before we go into wrapping up here. And that is Kinderman's wife. who's played by a character actor.
Zora
Lampert. Now, you may not know her, but her name is
Jessica. And if you don't know
her,
then fuck you, because there's a movie you haven't seen, so fuck you for not seeing it.
Yeah, exactly. Her name is Jessica. As in,
no,
let's
scare
Jessica
to death.
Right, oh, that's what I'm saying. Zora Lampert is just wonderful in her scenes with George C. Scott. And again, there's a warmth that comes through all the way through this. And that's what I love about this movie. And it's really, it gets out there too. And we'll get into that. So, do you have any favorite parts of this movie? Now, spoilers ahead, big time.
Well, yeah, we're not going to get any spoilers because next week, this is the first announcement of it, we are going to be doing a live watch of The Exorcist 3. And I'm going to, and Carl will definitely wax rhapsodic on his favorite scene from the movie, which is a scene from the very first Exorcist that freaking didn't use, but Blatty loved it so much that he put it in The Exorcist 3.
Yes. Yes.
It was, I mean, everybody in this movie is spot on, and everything really is spot on, except for poor Nicole Williamson, who basically was a guy brought into the middle of a shit situation and told he had to swallow shit.
Yeah. But the scene we're talking about, at least we can say this about it, okay? My favorite scene is there's this speech that George C. Scott and him and Father Dyer, who's played by Ed Flanders, have just seen the movie. It's a Wonderful Life. And Scott goes into this monologue about what's going on at home. And how many edits are there on the new Blu-ray?
There's one that they show, but they say that they filmed the scene four times, and not even in the one and using the movie, Ed could not keep a straight face.
It's got to be one of the most brilliantly, you know, funny, very straight-faced speeches I've ever heard, and it is brilliant. You know, it's brilliant.
Yeah. And to wrap it up, my thoughts are, thank you for giving us great dialogue. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. And great books, and a great legacy. William Peter Blatty was very much a part of my growing up. And it is, he had a long life, and God knows he gave us a lot, and I'm just thankful to have been alive while he was to experience the wonder that he gave us. So that's what I'd like to
say. And I'm really jealous of you because you was really around to see Ground Zero when The Exorcist hit.
Oh, absolutely. I was Ground Zero.
Yeah, you can talk about that all you want, but you never really will understand what it's like unless you were there.
Well, you know, I remember being in the theater, seeing it for the first time, and this was in Bradford. I saw it in the theater, too. That was the second time, but I saw it up in the drive-in. And man, I was just like, I was taken aback. I could not believe what I was seeing. And remember this, I'd seen a lot of sexploitation and stuff there, but I didn't expect to see, you know, Linda Blair going through what the hell she was going through. That's for sure.
Yeah. Okay, and with that, good night. We'll see you tomorrow night and later this week with the Exorcist thing. Thanks for putting up with this silliness, Carl.
Oh, not a problem, sir. Glad to do it. All right, good night, everyone.
And good night. No outro tonight. We're just walking out of the studio. Let's go get a drink and Blatty's on her, damn it.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm thinking of a Bloody Mary. What do you think?
All right. Okay. Good night, everybody.
Good night.